Sin makes a mess. We all know that's the case. There's no way to sugarcoat that awful reality. It's been like that since the fall of Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. There are always consequences for our sinful choices. What might seem pleasurable for a moment can turn into a lifelong struggle against obstacles, can turn into bondage to sin. Think of the choices that lead someone into the devastating lifestyle of addiction. Karen and I, we sadly heard of a family friend that we know of that's in treatment for cocaine addiction. And it's just sad just to hear just the consequences of choices and where they lead. But there's no getting away with it that sin makes a mess. It's hard to untangle. I spent some early years when we first moved to Baltimore working in a ministry with a gifted Christian counselor. And what struck me as couples came in, I didn't really have the gift of exhortation and what was, you know, really his gift area for dealing with all of these problem areas. And what struck me was just how tangled up things were. It was like a ball of yarn that's all tangled up. And you might pull on one thread and you're trying to help in this area, but then you find out everything's interconnected and it's just hard to, a life that's gone off the straight and narrow, it's hard to straighten it back out again. And so it's just so difficult because of sin. But we're going to see in this passage also that even though sin makes a mess, that God makes a way. That God is able to provide what we need for forgiveness of sins, to provide what we need for deliverance from the bondage of sin, to provide what we need for eternal life. Now, when a man tries to cover up his sin with futile attempts, like a patchwork of fig leaves, we see that that's just futile in terms of man's efforts. But we see that God, he can provide the seed of the woman who can offer up his sinless life in order to be a sacrifice for sin. Only God can clothe us with the righteousness of Jesus Christ and by his grace shower undeserving sinners with his grace and compassion and mercy and forgiveness. We're all undeserving sinners. We're all in bondage apart from Christ's deliverance and his salvation. We're in bondage to Satan and to sin and to self. We all need the salvation that God can provide. So this morning we get back to the roots of humanity here, the origin of sin in terms of the human race and some of its devastating consequences as God proclaims his condemnation and his judgments. But at the same time, we're going to witness throughout this passage the grace of God and the fact that he makes a way. So sin, this is really the second part of the two-part message we began last week. Sin leads to guilt, and guilt changes everything. Last week we looked at a guilty conscience, a guilty verdict, and then the guilty sentence that was issued upon the serpent. And this morning we'll look upon the guilty sentence upon the woman, Eve, the guilty sentence declared upon the man, Adam, and then God's divine provision and protection for guilty humanity. So verse 16, to the woman, he said, he directs his attention now away from the serpent, directs his attention to Eve, and God delivers this guilty sentence upon the woman. He says, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you shall bring forth children. So here's the pronouncement of cursing and of judgment. And it impacts that area of primary responsibility that is unique to a woman, that area of childbirth. In fact, in all of the gender confusion that we experience in our culture today about what's the role of a man and a woman, I mean, nobody can dispute it's only the woman that gives birth to the children. And the role of man and of woman, it remains distinct from a biological sense, just as God ordained it, and it should remain distinct in terms of roles that men and women play in the church, that they play in the family unit. God has ordained it this way. But here we're going to see some of the consequences of sin that are directed towards Eve and towards women in that fundamental arena of giving birth to children. So we have moms here that I'm sure from personal experience can testify that it's no lark to deliver. It's no easy street. It's no painless procedure. What might it have been like to give birth apart from the fall? To give birth in an ideal environment. You know, we can't even imagine really what it might have been like, but we know what it's like in our environment, and it's something that even though there's the joy that's set before you, there's the dread of, do I really have to go through this, and how am I going to be sustained going through this? And so the pain is unmistakable, and the pain has been multiplied, it says, by God, so that it's a reminder to us of the fallen state in which we live, that we are bringing this new life into a fallen world. We are bringing a life that is born in a state of depravity, a state of original sin, a state that's already compromised because of the sin of Adam and Eve. So we can see that this experience, it reflects the brokenness and the pain that's around us in this fallen world in which we live. It's interesting, Van Paranak, in his Hebrew expertise, he says these clauses here that speak of the woman's sorrow or pain or heartbreak or toil, the words that are used here, could have used a number of Hebrew words for labor pains, but he chose to use a word that has sort of a pun involved because it's very close in pronunciation to the word for tree. And so just as it was the fruit of the tree that caused the problem, and that eating of that was what entailed the sin, by way of a pun, he says, well, now upon the woman there's going to be this pain, this sorrow, this labor pain inflicted upon her. Dr. Jack Arnold, he writes, a woman's sense of success or failure in life is related to her children. A mother's heart is wrapped up with the life and career of her children, really maybe more so than even the father. She lives in and by her children. The meaning of her life is revealed in them. If they succeed, she has succeeded. If they fail, then she feels that failure, you know, maybe even more so. Turn over to 1 Timothy chapter 2, which references our passage here for this morning. 1 Timothy chapter 2, which makes some application for us in the New Testament church context based on what happened back at the days of Adam and Eve. It says, 1 Timothy 2, verse 12, it says, this is the Apostle Paul speaking, but I do not allow a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. He's talking in the context of the church official responsibilities and services. He says, but to remain quiet. Now, how this passage is just so disregarded today, I mean, you see all of these leadership teams of husband and wife and the justification that is made for that in so many circles, when the clear teaching, you only have to go to this verse here, and it says if you want to know God's heart on the matter, there's one way to obey God here and there's one way to disobey God, and it's very clear. And he goes on to explain verse 13, for it was Adam who was first created and then Eve, and it was not Adam who was deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. But now he goes on and he gives this statement of hope and of really what's involved in the life and the arena of a woman as what is so critical to her is the rearing of her children. It says, but women will be preserved through the bearing of children if they continue in faith and love and sanctity with self-restraint. And so there's a great mission that's set forth here for women. But the women, they enter into this mission through the gate or the portal of pain and of suffering, is how you enter into this. Stephen Cole, he says, God mercifully tempers the pain of childbirth with the great joy which children give. As Jesus said, he quotes from John 16, verse 21, whenever a woman is in travail, she has sorrow because her hour has come. But when she gives birth to the child, she remembers the anguish no more for joy that a child has been born into the world. And so there is certainly a great joy that's set before the woman as to the outcome of the event. But boy, it's definitely true, as God says, that he will greatly multiply pain in childbirth, and in pain you will bring forth children. Now the next pronouncement that God gives here is a bit more cryptic and has a number of different explanations. He says, yet your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. It's possible, given the context here, that because there is such pain involved in childbirth, that he's saying, yet despite this pain, it's not going to mean that a woman has no more sexual desire or attraction, or that there's no more procreation that takes place. No, a woman will still have desire for her husband in a physical and in a sexual sense. That's possible because of the context here. But I think it's more likely that this statement here is one of a condemnation to conflict in the marriage relationship, in the husband-wife relationship, that the word desire here is used more as it is in Genesis chapter 4, verse 7 in the immediate context, where it's talking about Cain and Abel, and it's talking there in Genesis 4, verse 7, it says, sin is crouching at the door, and its desire, the same word, its desire is for you, but you must master it. Sin has a desire. There's a desire for control. There's a desire to be in charge. There's a desire to manipulate. And that word here, I think going back in our context here in the passage directed to Eve, I think God is saying that, look, there as a result of the fall, the woman is going to have this conflict situation that she would not have been in the pre-fall state. In the pre-fall state, there was still the role of the husband being the leader. There was the role of the woman and the wife being the helper that's suitable to the man. But they were in complete union. They were in complete harmony. The man was not abusing his leadership in any type of tyrannical or domineering fashion. And the woman did not have any urge to be out from under that control and to assert control herself and to dominate the relationship. There was no conflict. There was no pressure in that situation. But what God is saying now is that the marriage relationship is going to be fraught with conflict. Because on the one hand, you're going to have the man who either will be passive and will not take the leadership that he should, or will be overly aggressive and will somehow abuse the woman, or will take this as to be a tyrannical, domineering type of leadership, which is wrong, which goes against the model that's given in Ephesians chapter 5 of how a husband needs to sacrificially love his wife as Christ loved the church. But on the part of the woman, there's going to be now this sinful desire to have control, to manipulate, to be able to dictate the terms of the relationship and the decisions that are made, rather than being in her role of helpmeet, and rather being in a submissive role as a wife should be. And so I think that is the essence of what he says here when he says your desire shall be for your husband, and yet you're going to find that he shall rule over you, and this is going to cause tension and conflict in the relationship because of all the different ways in which that relationship can be abused and can end up in a wrong type of picture. And so it's this tension, it's this frustration that enters into the equation here that we have to come to grips with, and that makes this such a tragic consequence to see how things could have been versus how things are now. Certainly, if you go on, as we do through the book of Genesis, we can look at situations where this is played out, whether it's Sarah doing things that Abraham doesn't want, or whether it's, you know, different contexts in the relationship between the men and the women. As we go on through Genesis, we have Rachel and Leah in chapters 29 and 30. They seek to manipulate their husband as they compete with one another. We'll see Tamar trying to manipulate her father-in-law in chapter 38 when he doesn't provide her with a husband. We'll just see different situations where some of this tension maybe is played out. But I think that this is just something that we have to keep in mind, and from a practical standpoint, it's something that we have to guard against to try to see that our relationship and our marriage functions according to the order that God has intended for it to be, and that the man and the husband plays his role accordingly, and that the wife plays her role accordingly. I'll read what Bob Deffenbaugh, what he says here by way of application. He says, to those men and women who wish to disregard God's instruction, I must say that this is precisely what Satan desires. Just as he drew Eve's attention to the restriction of the one tree, so he wants women to ponder the restriction that's placed upon women today. Throw off your shackles, Satan urges. Find self-fulfillment. God is keeping you from what is best, he whispers. And it's a lie. God's rules have reasons, whether we understand them or not. Dr. MacArthur, he says, the woman is also given a curse in the realm where she lives her life. It affects her childbearing and it affects her relationship to her husband, those two realms. The home is where God designed a woman to be. That is her realm. I mean, there's certainly practical application for us today, too, in terms of making that your primary role. And so God places a unique curse on her realm so that she's going to find life particularly difficult in her relationship with her children and her relationship with her husband. Childbirth itself will take her right down to the edge of death. Think of all the situations, even our modern medicine, with all the anesthesia and the medicine we have, it still can't make for a delightful experience in terms of childbirth. You know, all the medicine and the doctor care that we have and the way that they'll dress up the maternity room, oh, we want to make this just a great experience, you know, it's just not. And so MacArthur says, she desires to have her own way, to have her own will, to dominate, and the husband controls her. So there in the very sphere of her life, she finds the curse operating, which is a constant reminder, designed by God to be a constant reminder of the terrible nature of sin. So that's God giving his attention to women, giving his attention to Eve with this guilty sentence. But now in verses 17 to 19, he cycles around in this structure that we mentioned last week, where now he comes back and gives both barrels now in verses 17 to 19 directed against Adam, directed against really the more responsible party, the one who should have been in a role of leadership, the one who was not deceived. And now he's going to deliver the guilty sentence upon the man. And so it says, then to Adam, verse 17, he said, he begins, interestingly, in verse 17, he begins giving a reason for why he's proclaiming the curse. He didn't have to start with a reason when he was talking to the woman here. But as he talks to Adam, he gives a reason for why he is going to deliver some harsh reality now to Adam. And he says, it's because you have listened to the voice of your wife. You have eaten from the tree which I commanded you that you could not eat, you should not eat. So you have abdicated your role of leadership. You should have maintained your headship. You should have given priority to my word rather than to the word of your wife. Certainly, God is not counseling husbands here that, look, it's a bad thing to listen to your wives. You know, you really shouldn't listen to the counsel that's offered by your wives. That's not what God is saying at all. I mean, the valuable help and counsel that God gives us comes through our wives, and we husbands can give great testimony to how we have greatly erred in situations where we did not listen to the voice and the counsel of our wife. But God is making a contrast here between what Adam did in terms of the value he put on the counsel of his wife and her suggestions versus the command of God. And so this contrast, it's first of all a contrast in terms of the source of the spoken word. Are you going to consider the source more valuable that comes from the one who's the helper, the wife, the ones created by God as the suitable helper? Or are you going to give more credence and value to the source as it comes from God the Creator himself? So it says, look at the source of the instruction. As these two are in conflict, you're dealing with a situation where the words aren't in union, they're in conflict. And he says, in that situation, he says, look at the source of where the counsel and the suggestion, the instruction, the commandment is coming from. And he says, certainly, you should give more credence to the Creator than to the one who was created to be your helpmate. Secondly, there's a contrast in the intensity of the spoken word. It says that the word that's used with respect to what Eve offered up was more of a suggestion, or was more of, you know, she was trying to get Adam to do something, and so she was trying to move him in that direction. But when it comes to what God spoke, it terms it as a commandment. This came by way of commandment from God. So you have the source, and then you have the intensity of the spoken word. But obviously, most importantly, you have the contrast in the authority of the spoken word. Which should have more authority in governing our lives? Is it the counsel from where? Anybody else, no matter where it comes from? Or is it the spoken commandment that is a clear commandment from God? And so the issue of obedience and disobedience becomes very clear. So God offers this up by way of the explanation as to why he now is going to pronounce a cursing and a condemnation upon Adam. And it's interesting, the pronouncement of cursing, verses 17 to 19, he doesn't directly curse man. He curses the ground, which involves the environment of work that is so much the primary environment for man in order to provide for his family, in order to provide sustenance and the food that is necessary. What God does, he says, cursed is the ground because of you. Cursed is the ground. Now, of course, if you live in an agrarian society, this right away strikes up with extra importance for you. And we have to carry over the application of this to our work environment in which each of us men function every day. It's interesting, the testimony of this curse is certainly recognized if you flip over to chapter 5, verse 29 and 30. Beginning in verse 28, talks about Lamech. Lamech lived 182 years, so he had a long time to work. He became the father of a son. He called his name Noah, saying, "This one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed." So his testimony with respect to all these many years of labor was, wow, we need relief. We need deliverance. We need rest. This has been a toilsome, very difficult experience. And it goes back to this verse in Genesis 3 where God, speaking to Adam, cursed is the ground because of you. So the environment has every reason to be very upset against humanity because we've done it a disservice. All of creation is now in a state of this groaning, wanting and waiting to that moment when it will be redeemed, when Christ returns, and when there will be a restoration to idyllic conditions that are pre-fall types of conditions. But we were designed not to be without work. Work is not the curse. Okay, work is never portrayed as a curse. Work was going to be important as a role that man would play and a function that man would have, but it was to be a pleasurable experience rather than to be a chore. And so now what happens is the ground fights against our efforts to cultivate the soil. And so he goes on and he says, here's how the condemnation works itself out in terms of the conflict between the environment and what man is trying to accomplish. Man has certain goals in his work. He's trying to accomplish certain things. And instead of cooperating with what man wants to do, environment is actually an antagonist, an enemy in that situation. It says, "In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread." So there's no surprise here. There's nothing that needs to be exegeted here because we can all, as men, testify that when it comes to work, there's all types of things that cause us difficulty and angst. And every week, they have things that we come up against and we say, wow, this is painful. This is a struggle. I wish I had it easier. Maybe I should be in a job where things would be a lot easier. God says, don't kid yourself. You know, things are going to be hard in whatever job situation you're in. Adjust your expectations based on the fall. You are in a situation where God is going to make it difficult for you by way of using the environment against you and your situation against you. So don't have the expectation when you go in on Monday that things are going to be rosy and smooth sailing and I should have this easy pathway in terms of work. First of all, you better have a work ethic and be committed to work. God says if a man won't work, he shouldn't eat. So there's an area of responsibility here. We're moved way beyond responsibility. We're not even considering that situation. We're here where man's committed to work. They've taken on the responsibility. And yet, they now struggle within that realm where sometimes they frequently, you know, they're just pulling their hair out saying, I can't even manage this. This is strenuous, it's exhausting, it's painful, it's an ongoing struggle because of all the difficulties and the problems that I have to face. And so we have to adjust our expectations that work is going to be a grind. God has designed it to be a grind. He's designed it to remind us again of our dependence upon Him, of our need to be in obedience to God, that everything that we do, we must draw our strength from God's grace in order to give us all that we need to accomplish the work that we're setting out to do. It's not that we need God's grace just to minister in some spiritual capacity. We need God's grace in the workplace Monday through Friday to accomplish what God wants us to get done there. So it's something that could have been pleasurable before the fall has turned into a chore and has turned into somewhat of a drudgery and has turned into something that is very difficult. Psalm 127. Verse 2 says, man is going to eat the bread of sorrow. It's going to be through sorrow and through toil and through pain that man is able to produce the bread that he needs. I like Dr. MacArthur, as he goes through the book of Ecclesiastes from this perspective and quotes a bunch of verses, just the context of what happens in our work situation. He says, quoting some verses from Ecclesiastes, he says, Solomon writes, I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me. Do you find that to be the case sometimes, men? And sometimes work is just grievous. Everything is futility and striving after the wind. So I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And the worst part is when I've done so well and I've accumulated a lot, then I've got to give it to somebody else. And he says, I don't know if he's going to be a wise man or a fool, but he's going to have control over all the fruit of my labor, which I have labored. That's vanity, too. And so he goes on and he says, these days of labor, they're painful, they're grievous. Even at night, the mind can't rest or sleep because you're just thinking of difficulties and problems and things that have to get resolved. So, you know, we groan in ourselves. We think, oh, you know, I can get to age 65 to 70, wherever it is, and then I can retire, you know, and maybe I can have some ease, some break from this tedium, from this drudgery. Well, for Adam, think about Adam. It was 930 years he worked. That's a long time to work in a physical environment, tilling the ground that's fighting against you with thorns and brambles and thistles in order to eke out a meager existence where you could provide for yourself and your family. And so God says, don't have your expectation that there's ever going to be any type of easy street in this life, because the role of man is going to be fraught with the frustration that comes in this particular realm of work and all that is involved. But he goes beyond that in verse 19, and he says, this is going to happen from a time frame. It says, until you return to the ground, because from it you are taken, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Of course, there's also an aspect of God's grace, even in this picture here, because God could have, at the moment that man sinned, God could have ended their existence right then and could have condemned them back to dust right then, because he said, in the day that you eat thereof, you shall die. And God executed that judgment in a spiritual sense of separation from him by virtue of sin. But he did not execute the physical part of that until 930 years for Adam. And so there is yet, though, that effect that lies before us, that death is what awaits. At some point in time, we're going to return to the ground, because from it you were taken, you're dust, and to dust you shall return. And so this is what is offered in terms of the guilty sentence upon man. So we've seen the guilty sentence upon the woman, the guilty sentence upon the man, and yet in verses 20 to 24, we see, by way of God's grace, we see his divine provision and his protection for guilty humanity. Because he could have wiped out, as I said, he could have wiped out all of posterity right then, so that there were no children born, that there was no seed of the woman that would come. But we already know that he's made the promise. That's why we read back in verse 15 today, again, to know that God has said there is going to be this seed of the woman that God is going to provide. And so there is going to be this posterity that we can look forward to. And so it should not be surprising, even though it might seem somewhat inserted, verse 20, as if it's sort of stuck in there, it's actually in context, because it has to do with Adam having a sense of hope and understanding that, you know, I'm not going to call Eve, I'm not going to name her the Grim Reaper, I'm not going to name her Death, you know, the mother of all the dead. No, he says, I'm going to give her the name of Eve, because Eve means life. She's the mother of all the living. She speaks to the fact that she's still alive and is going to be granted the opportunity to bear children. And there's this hope, this thread that God has woven through this fabric here that says, let's look forward to the seed of the woman that will come, that will be able to conquer Satan and sin and death. And so Adam understands that the hope for all humanity, for restoration to paradise, it lies in this seed of the woman. And that's why he renames his wife Eve. Rather than just woman, now she's called Eve, as a reminder that she is the mother of all the living. She will bear offspring, and one of them will be that victorious seed that conquers Satan and conquers death. So then God, we see in verse 21, we see how God responds to all of these pronouncements that are so tragic in terms of the consequences of the fall, and yet God responds in gracious fashion. It says in verse 21, "And the Lord God himself, the Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them." So only God can provide the covering for sin that we need. What Adam and Eve attempted to do with the fig leaves, again, was inadequate. But God steps in, and even though it's unspoken here, it seems to be intimated that this came by way of sacrifice, that this is where death in the animal kingdom is introduced, that God had to kill whatever the animals were that he got obtained these skins from. And so these animals were offered up, and this was a sacrifice to God, and the life of the blood is in the flesh, and the life of the flesh is in the blood. And so God slayed the animals there and took the blood and was able to see that as, again, the initial type of the sacrifice that would come from the sacrifice of Christ. And so there's this covering that is made, and it all gets back to the importance of the grace of God. Karen mentioned in the prayer time how we had an opportunity last evening to be at this service, a testimonial service, a anniversary recognition service for Pastor Dan Broadwater. And in his comments, what he gave testimony to, which I thought was very appropriate, was just how over 40 years of ministry, he was struck by the grace of God as being so foundational. Grace being the favor, the undeserved favor that God pours out on each of us that deserve the opposite from God. We deserve his judgment, his condemnation, and yet how God pours out his undeserved favor. And this is what is emphasized, I think, in this passage here, is that God is going to make every provision for man and give the opportunity so that man can place his faith in the provision that God makes for sin, rather than having to face the judgment and the condemnation on our own and take the penalty for sin ourselves, that we can avail ourselves through faith of the propitiation, of the atonement that God has made for us. And so our lives, we all are in that situation of being undeserving sinners that deserve God's wrath, and yet he pours out his grace and his favor in so many abundant ways. And so this takes place here in this clothing that God does as he provides this covering for mankind. But then he goes on in verses 22 to 24, and God provides protection from another venue, from another perspective, a protection that we might not have thought much of, but was very necessary to protect Adam and Eve. And it says, verse 22, "Then the Lord God said, Behold, the man has become like one of us," just in a small sense, "has become like one of us, knowing good and evil," not the way that God knows good and evil, but knowing from an experiential sense, having actually committed evil, man understands from an inward sense of experiential identification. We know what sin and depravity and evil and darkness, we know what that's all about now in a bad sense. And so what God says is, wow, we don't want man to live forever in this condition. It would be tragic for man to go on and be consigned to live forever, all eternity, consigned to hell in this condition. And so God says here, "Lest he stretch out his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever." God goes on to say that what he did then was God sent him out. He expelled him from the Garden of Eden in order to cultivate the ground from which he was taken. So he drove the man out. These are strong words that are used here of expulsion and of driving man out. You know, man was reluctant to leave the paradise of the Garden of Eden. Wouldn't you be reluctant to leave that environment? And yet it was for our own good that God had to drive Adam and Eve out and say, look, you know, you can't be trusted. It's not like I can give you a prohibition of, hey, be careful, don't eat from that one tree. You can, everything else is okay. We've tried that, you know, that didn't go so well. You know, we can't trust man now in your fallen state to obey that command. And so by way of protection, God has to now drive man out and provide protection himself. So there's this expulsion that takes place from the garden. God sets up this guard, it says, at the east of the Garden of Eden. He stationed the cherubim, the flaming sword, which turned every direction to guard the way to the tree of life. That must have been quite a stunning visible spectacle to Adam and Eve whenever they longed to be back in that idyllic environment that they had formerly known. As as Adam's laboring away and he's toiling and he's sweating and he's in agony, as Eve is giving birth and feeling the pain and feeling the struggle in her marriage relationship and the tension, to look there and be able to look back and when you see the sunset, you know, to be able to say, oh, back over there, that's where the cherubim is guarding that. That's where God has said, hey, they're the only way to be restored to that type of environment is through the seed of the woman, is through the faith in the provision that God has made. And so Stephen Cole, he writes, so the curse shows us that God allows us to suffer consequences for our sin. In fact, he makes us suffer consequences for our sin. Sometimes those consequences are directly related to some sin we've committed. At other times, we just suffer the consequences of living in a fallen world where there's sin all around us, impacting us in every way. While God graciously tempers the severity of the consequences with glimmers of grace, the consequences are real. They remind us that with the holy God, sin is serious. But God's grace triumphs, and that he doesn't leave us to suffer the ultimate consequences of sin. And so our message today, as we study this passage, we know sin makes a mess. It makes a mess in our lives. We think of our families. We think of raising children. We think of just when people make bad decisions. They make sinful choices and the consequences that arise. Sin makes a mess. It's a tangle of yarn that we're not able to untangle and set straight. But God makes a way. God is gracious. God makes every provision for us so that we might have reconciliation and peace with him and that we might enjoy paradise with him. Let's pray.